You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
We're continuing our series through Shepherding a Child's Heart, and we'll be loosely covering chapters 9 and 10 with some material from some other books, as we usually do as we work through that. So we'll open with a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Father, I come before you tonight. I thank you for your word and the wisdom it gives on the topic of parenting. I thank you for the wisdom you've given to the men and women whose books I've read in putting this course together. I pray that I would learn from that, not only how to put a course together, but give me wisdom, give all of us wisdom as we parent our children. Help us to encourage one another. Help us to be faithful. Help those who don't yet have children to seek wisdom right now. Help those who have already had children, and perhaps who have already finished raising them, to still seek to learn and to know, to be an encouragement to their grandchildren. Give all of us your wisdom. Help us to grow together. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. So this is our sixth lesson in our series on parenting. And tonight we'll be continuing on with the topic of communication. We introduced the topic of methods last week, and we started on communication. We're going to finish up communication tonight. So in terms of the course as a whole, I'd like to give a brief review at the beginning so we get the basics really nailed down in our minds. So we started out with four lessons on the foundations of parenting. The foundational text that we've covered, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother," which is the first commandment with promise, "that it may be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." We are called to raise up children without forgetting that we are called to raise those children up. So we're raising up children. We need to remember we've got children, but we don't want them to stay children. We want them to grow into adults. And so we need to let our children be children without letting them stay children. So we begin by protecting them from the dangers that are out there in the world, and then we continue on by intentionally training them to deal with those dangers for themselves. And so if we're to be faithful to this as our mission, it isn't enough just to manage their external behavior for as long as they are in our house. We need to actively shepherd their hearts so that they can be prepared for life. So that's where we started. Then we moved on, lesson two, talking about the shaping of children, the fact that we have a lot of influence and we're responsible for how we use that influence, but also the outcome is not only the pressures that are brought to bear on our children, but also the shape of their own hearts and how they're responding to that. So there are influences on them, and then there's the orientation of their hearts. And we want to be watchmen who do not have bloody hands when it comes to our children. The third lesson dealt with the issue of authority. Though our culture is confused about authority, God is not. And so as a parent, you need to know you're a person under authority. You are a person in authority. Your children are under your authority and your authority. Now, you may not use your authority well, but the fact that you are in authority and your children are not is good for your children. And understanding these four truths, it gives you confidence in your role, clarity in your objectives, and humility in your approach. It enables you to discipline out of authority and not out of anger. And you engage in correction, not in punishment, when you are disciplining. And then we talked, finally, to wrap up these foundations, we talked about parenting goals. So we worked through the important topic of goals. And our goal as parents is to prepare our children for the day of judgment, to equip them for the day of reward. Prepare them for the day of judgment so that they are ready to stand before God and equip them. It's not just a negative thing that we don't want them to do naughty things. We want to equip them for the day of reward positively. And this is the only truly adequate goal that we can have as parents. Everything else needs to be judged by and subordinated to this fundamental goal. And then we had four lessons that were foundational. And now we have four lessons on the foundations of parenting. And now we're having four lessons on methods for parenting. Last week, we covered the introduction to parenting methods. So we started with discarding unbiblical methods. Mere behavior modification, whether through bribery or emotional manipulation, is not enough. We can't just latch on to the evil desires in our children's hearts and seek to use those evil desires for our benefit. We're supposed to be shepherding those desires so that the desires of their heart begin to change. So we talked about we need to discard biblical methods, and then we need to develop consistency. And we need to develop consistency of several kinds. Consistency over time, in terms of what we say one day and what we say another day. We need to be consistent with reality so that when we tell our children things, those things are actually, when we give them instructions, we know what they're actually capable of, and we don't tell them to do things that they cannot do. Consistency between what we say and what we do. Consistency between mom and dad if both parents are in the home. And, of course, consistency between public and private behavior. And we'll talk a little bit more about consistency tonight. And then we need to discover communication. So this is really what launches us into what we're covering tonight. Communication is dialogue, not monologue. Communication focuses on understanding. We're not just trying to impart information. We're trying to get our children to understand. And that means that we need to seek to understand them as well. And communication seeks incarnation, and communication asks the right sort of questions. So these were sort of four foundational principles for communication. Tonight, we're going to pick up where we left off with communication and seek to dive a little deeper into this vitally important topic. But any questions about some of the things that we've covered up to this point before we move on to where we're headed tonight? All right. So the parenting strategy, the first thing that we need to consider is that communication is broader than we sometimes think. The parenting strategy of many parents could be reduced to this: give the rules, correct misbehavior, and administer discipline. Now, are we supposed to give rules? Are we supposed to correct misbehavior? Are we supposed to administer discipline?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. But if that is the extent of our communication with our children, how's that going to work out for you? Not very good. And yet, as the author Ted Tripp has talked about, when he's gone and he's asked parents and he's asked them detailed questions, it turns out that for many parents, that's about 90% of their communication. And that's an easy mode for all of us to fall into. That's the default, right? That if our children aren't misbehaving, we're not worried about them. When they're out of control, we're worried about them. So as long as they don't misbehave, then we're not being proactive in communicating with them and shepherding their hearts. And so then, over time, and here's where it really gets messy, is we become the people that make their life unpleasant. And so when they have a choice, they don't want to be around us anymore, because that's all they associate us with, is discipline. And maybe they know that our discipline is fair. Maybe they're not completely rebellious. But that's all the relationship that we have. And so when our authority begins to diminish, or our ability to enforce, our power over them begins to diminish, our influence with them evaporates, because we haven't built a foundation that can continue on. Now, certainly, these are things that we need to do. We're going to talk next week about the importance of rules and correcting misbehavior. But rules and discipline alone are not going to give you the sort of relationship with your children in which rules and discipline will have the effects that we intend. So it's not just that rules and discipline alone are not enough, but it's also, if you want rules and discipline to have the effects you intend, there's got to be more than rules and discipline. Right? If you're going to have a plant, and you have a plant and you have all these beautiful roots, right? You've got this plant and you're going to transplant it. Well, you've got all these roots here, but if you have a pot, right, and you've got this big tree, you know, you want this fig tree maybe in your house. And so you get this little pot and you cut holes in the pot and you stick the roots out of the pot. How's that going to work? What do you need if you want to plant a plant in your house for it to keep going? What? Bigger pot. But what needs to be in the pot? If the roots are going to absorb water, what do they need to be in? They need to be in soil, right? And communication is like the soil in which the roots of discipline are able to absorb the nutrients that they need. Without the soil, the roots aren't going to do any good. And that is the case with communication and rules and discipline. We need to be more than just authority figures. God is the boss of everyone. He's an authority figure for everyone. But God's relationship with us as his children is not limited to giving us rules, is it? God's communication with us is much broader than that. So, what about us? What's your go-to strategy when something is going wrong? Do you only seek to add more rules and more restrictions when rules and restrictions haven't worked? Or do you seek to improve communication? Any thoughts or questions about that before we move on? Janine? We got a microphone coming right to you.
Especially with our older children, most of the time it starts about 12-ish, a little, maybe sometimes a little younger. We take them aside, have a conversation more than like sitting there engaging more rules or saying, you broke this rule, and monologuing to them, basically. We want to make sure of what's going on in their hearts. And we want to know what the motive is and if we've done something to offend them, because, you know, we do that too. And so we just have a really long conversation about what's going on.
Yeah. I think that's really important to have that. And that's what we're going to be talking about, is different types of communication. Anyone else before we move on? Brother Dave, Andrew's got a mic for you.
I was just going to say it's important to remember also that the method of communication is important. From the time they're newborns, obviously you can't converse with them. They don't understand. And yet mothers and, to an extent, fathers can communicate. It's almost like being with a deaf person or a blind person. They pick up on things because God gives them that. Mm-hmm. And we need to remember that that's how they start, and that'll continue to be picked up later. You may be speaking and intending a certain thing, but the younger they are, the more they're going to pick up on tone and your actions rather than just what you're saying. So it can ring hollow. So if they don't trust you, then they won't follow you.
Yep. It's really good. So there are a lot of different forms. Oh, do we have a mic? Oh. Zachary's, did you raise your hand? Zachary's right behind you.
I was just going to say, kind of to add on to what he was talking about with the trust, I think going to your children when you've wronged them and apologizing to them and being willing to do that can speak volumes to your child.
Absolutely.
As well, because that shows that what you're teaching them, you're following yourself.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. So there are a lot of different forms of communication, just like there are a lot of different things that go into healthy soil. Healthy soil isn't just one thing. It's a lot of things all together in the same place that you get all the different nutrients that you need for a plant. And so I took Tripp's list. He has a list of different forms of communication in chapter 9. I took that as a foundation. I rearranged it a little bit and added some things from other sources. But before we dive into the types of communication that we should be having with our children, we need to spend just a minute underscoring why it's important to have so many tools in our communication belt. So many of you are much handier than I am, and some of you have many tools. So I don't have many tools. I have a small handful of tools that I can never find because my children think that they are toys. About the only decent tool that I have is a screwdriver. Now, it's a great screwdriver, but I am very limited in what I can accomplish with this screwdriver. I have a few other tools, but not many beyond that. But Matthew or Gilead or some of you others that have many tools as well, you've got, how many tools do you have, Matthew? I'm sure you don't have an actual, maybe you do have an actual count. You have a lot. You showed me your tool shed. You have hundreds and many, many, many tools and vehicles and all these things. And with those tools, you can accomplish a whole lot more than I could with my screwdriver. That is the case for many of you have lots and lots of tools. And as we're trying to raise our children are not always going to need the same thing. We need to have more than one tool in the belt in terms of communication. So 1 Thessalonians 5:14 says this, "We exhort you, brethren, warn them that are unruly, comfort the feeble-minded, support the weak, and be patient towards all men." If we warn the feeble-minded and we support the unruly, how are things going to go? Not very well. And the same principle is true with our children. We need to pick, not just have lots of tools, because if I had Matthew's tools, I would still not be able to do what Matthew does, because I would not know what tool went with which thing. And similarly, I would suppose, if Matthew had my library, he might not know which book went with which problem to be able to use it in that way, because those are the tools that I use to do the jobs that I do, right? So it's not just important to have, well, I've got all these tools. We need to know what to do with them and to use them at the right time so that our children can flourish. There's a quote here from Gregory the Great, who wrote this wonderful book on pastoral care back in the 500s, I believe. He says this: "What often helps some people will cause harm in others, just as herbs that are nutritious to some animals will kill others. Or the way, I have no idea if this is true or not. I was unable to verify it. The way the gentle, some of you may know though, the way the gentle hissing will calm a horse but excite a puppy. Likewise, the medicine that cures one disease will spur another. And the bread that fortifies a grown man can kill a young child." And then he goes on and he just has the rest of the book. It's over 100 pages of, you should counsel these people this way and these people this way. They don't need the same thing. And the same principle is true with our children, that when our children are high-spirited and they are behaving, you know, off the charts crazy, they need one kind of communication. When they're down in the dumps and depressed, they need another kind of communication. And what parents can sometimes do is give rules, and guess what? Rules, and guess what? Rules. Discipline. That's all we've got. It's like trying to fix a plumbing problem with a screwdriver. You're not going to get very far. You need plumbing tools. And if you're trying to fix an electrical problem with plumbing tools, well, you're going to get in some messy situations, but you're also not going to fix the problem. You may cause a lot more harm. As it is, as with preaching, as Gregory the Great talked about, so with parenting, it's very important that we use the right set of tools. So don't instruct when a rebuke is needed or vice versa. So there's a number of tools. There's probably more than this. You could have a fuller set of tools, but some essential minimum tool set that you need for raising your children. Instruction, encouragement, correction, rebuke, confession, affection, entreaty, warning, example, and prayer. This is the minimum viable tool set for raising children. You probably need more than this, but you're not going to do very well if you have less than this. So let's start with instruction. Instruction is the process of providing a lesson or a precept or information that's going to help your children to understand their rules. Children need to be taught more than rules. They need instruction. Children need constant teaching. And you, as their parent, are their God-appointed teacher. Here's the pattern we find in Deuteronomy. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. Now, we need to be balanced here. So the picture is given, and it's not like, you know, other teachers are never involved and no one else can ever teach your children. That's not the point. But the point is that the parents are responsible to teach their children the ways of God. And they're to teach them all the time. This is a continual process. It's not like, okay, you've had your lesson. You've gotten all the teaching that you need. No, we're to be instructing our children about many different things. Now, we need to be balanced here. You don't need to answer every stalling why about the mysteries of life when you've already sent them to bed. So they've gone to bed, and they want to know what's a question they would want to know? They want to know something about horses, and they've gone to bed. And they just have to know why horses are different colors. Well, you should be teaching your children, but you should also be teaching your children that bedtime is more important than their curiosity, right? So you don't just give them every possible answer to every question. But on the other hand, you don't need to, you know, always, they can stop anything that's going on. I want to know something. Well, they want to know a lot of things. And they should be taught a lot of things, but they should also be taught to ask questions at the right time. On the other hand, you need to be actively and intentionally teaching them how the world works, not just reminding them of the rules you've set up in your house. See, here's the thing. We're tempted to say, as long as I can get them to keep my rules, then I'm doing my job. But your job is not to teach them your rules, though you're going to need to do that to teach them anything else. Your job is to teach them about the whole world. right? So if all they know is how to stay on your good side, how is that going to equip them to live life out there in the world and to flourish and prosper? It's not. They're going to have to learn those lessons from other teachers who may not have their best interest at heart. So what should we teach our children? Well, a lot of things. This is a very partial list, but here's a few things. We should teach them about God, about sin and death and repentance and the judgment to come. Don't just assume that they'll pick up on it at church. Don't just say, well, that's the pastor's job to teach them about those things. My job is to teach them about other things. Well, you're responsible. Like, you can have other teachers involved. There's nothing wrong with that. That's right. You should have them in church. You should teach them to listen in the preaching and in the teaching so that they should learn things. But you should also be involved with that. You should be asking them, having conversations with them. Say, what was the sermon about? And don't be satisfied with God. If they're three, okay, that's probably all right. But if they're seven or eight, you should be asking a little bit more questions than that. Were you paying attention at all? Do you remember anything from the sermon, right? And this is not like, oh, if you just ask the right questions, they're going to pay such attention and they're going to give you a detailed outline. No, a seven-year-old or an eight-year-old, even a nine-year-old, isn't always going to do that. They're not always going to pay attention. And not all children have equal capacity for picking up on the main point of a sermon. But if they're listening, they should be able to remember something more specific than God or the Bible, right? That ask more questions. Say, next time maybe you're not going to be coloring because you need to be listening. And ask about what Generations is about. We put the main point of the Generations lesson in the bulletin so you can ask about it. You can do family devotions and you can ask questions about that. Because here's the thing, even if you know they learn all these things that they're supposed to learn, you can actually observe how they're behaving. And so you know how what they're hearing connects with what they're behaving. And you can make application to their life that no one else is going to be able to do. Because you're their parents. And they're under your care. So teach them about God. Teach them social skills. Don't just get mad at them when they cross an invisible line. I can't believe that you did that. Oh, that's terrible. That's not actually teaching them anything. I mean, now, if you've given them the instruction and now they're disobeying your instruction, well, that has to be dealt with. But it's not fair to them to be upset at them because they've broken some social faux pas that you've never taught them. So teach them how to talk and how to walk. Teach them how to dress and how to stand and how to sit. Teach them, like, don't assume that they're going to get everything. Like, teach them when two people are talking, how far away should they stand? To be polite, but to also know that they're trying to get your attention, right? Really practical lessons. Don't assume that they already know anything. Don't just tell them. So, here's an example. Go to bed. Don't get out of bed unless there's an emergency. A four-year-old doesn't know what an emergency is. You've got to teach them what an emergency is. To a four-year-old, their question about horses feels like an emergency. I don't know what an emergency is, but I think this must be it. No, an emergency is someone bleeding, right? Like, give them some ideas about what an emergency might be. Give them really practical details. And here's the thing about social skills. Don't assume that because one child picked up on it by osmosis, that all your children actually know and are just being difficult. Because some children pick up on things more slowly than others. Some children are better at reading books. Some children are better at observing and adapting. I'll leave you to imagine which of those categories that I fell into as a child and even as an adult. I'll give you a hint. It was not observing and adapting. Teach them life skills. Teach them how to handle money, how to keep from being scammed in financial transactions, how to drive, how to shoot. If there's a skill that for whatever reason you don't know, as should be obvious, skills in the tools department, many of those are not going to be in my bailiwick to be teaching my children. But I'm glad that I have good friends in this church that when they're of the proper age, I can say, hey, brother so-and-so, could you teach Petey? Or could you teach sister so-and-so? Could you teach Chloe this thing that I want them to know that they should be knowing that maybe I didn't get taught or maybe I was taught and didn't pay attention to and now I have something that I don't know that'd be good for them to know? And so take advantage of the community of the church. It's one of the benefits of the co-op that we're able to use one another's skills, but it's not just in the co-op. This can be in more broadly in life skills altogether, where you have close community and you can learn from one another. It was actually, Brother Gilead is the maintenance guy at church. And so Ethy was like, "Mommy, can you fix this?" "No." "Can Daddy fix it?" "No." "Can Brother Gilead fix it?" I don't think, whatever it was, I don't think it was actually fixable. But it was just interesting that he knew that there were people, there were wheels within wheels when it came to fixing things. And so he had that figured out. I don't know why I got off on that. Don't assume that all your children are going to automatically pick up on these things. Just because some children got something without instruction doesn't mean that all children will. So especially if they're on the spectrum to one degree or another, as many children are, you may need to be more explicit with some than you would need to be with others. So you may need to say very specifically, stand this many feet apart from people when you're talking to them. Don't do this. Do this, right? Don't assume that they're being stubborn and rebellious if you haven't taken the time to break down the behavior that you're trying to get them to learn in simple terms so that they know it and can replicate it. Because even if they don't pick up on things automatically, they can learn what they're supposed to do. And you're helping them by seeing what they don't know and teaching it to them. Give your children a good education. Not just social skills, not just life skills, but also academic skills. The goal of a good education is not to check off a bunch of boxes to keep child CPS out of your house. That's not, like, the point of education is to avoid, is not just to say, hey, nobody ever investigated me and my children, you know, didn't flunk a standardized test, so I've done my job. No, the goal of education is to give them the tools that they need to learn for the rest of their lives and to impart to them the desire to keep learning. Give your children the best tools you possibly can give them. It's something worth sacrificing for. It's something worth stretching your own self for to be able to say, well, I got this level of education and this has served me to this degree, but I can offer my children more. If you got given a, you know, four-tool set, you got a screwdriver and you got a hammer and you got a wrench, well, that's great. You should be grateful for what you were given. Maybe somebody had less than you. But if you can give them a full set of Milwaukee power tools or whatever brand you prefer and have them graduate with that, why wouldn't you do that, right? Give them a lot better tools than you received. An education is not just about academics and prestige. It's about the imparting of tools and the development of the character to use them wisely and well. We'll be talking more about this point in detail when we come to formation here in 2 weeks, one of the lessons that's going to come. So communication should involve far, far more than generalized instruction. It should involve far, far more generalized instruction than restrictive rules. So the primary key of communication shouldn't be, don't do this or I'll be upset at you, right? You need some of that, but you need a whole lot more. You've been given to me for this short amount of time. And I want to equip you for life as well as I possibly can. And I want to teach you what I know. And if I know that I don't know something and I have suffered because of it, I'm going to find someone who does know that something who can help both of us perhaps to learn it well. And we have a wonderful resource in the community that we have that between the different men and women in this church, there are very few life skills that someone won't at least be able to point you in the right direction on. And that's what we're supposed to do, where we're a family together and we equip one another so that we're able to do more in the next generation than we're able to do ourselves right now in this generation. So communication should involve instruction. Any questions about that before we move on to the next point? Once, twice. Communication should also involve encouragement. It isn't enough just to tell our children what they need to know. We also need to encourage them when they're struggling to remember it, as all of us do with the lessons that we need to know. Children, like adults, need hope. They need to know that their present frustration and inability is not going to last forever. They need to know that you believe in them and see value in them, even and especially when you must correct them. and correct them, and correct them, and correct them. Hebrews 12 puts it like this, "Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed." I like the ESV translation of these verses. "Therefore lift up your drooping hands, and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed." When your children are limping, your goal isn't, as a parent, isn't to say, "I see you limping over there. That's a limp. Let me tell you, if you didn't know it, you got a limp." Who's that going to help? When our children are limping, that which is lame, you need to make straight paths. So rather than putting things further out of joint, things can be healed. We need to learn to see the upsides to their weaknesses, so we have something to encourage them with. Rachel Jankovich says this. I just love this quote that she said. Say your two-year-old son is defiant. Imagine he looks a consequence, you, in the face, and laughs. You should see virtue in that sin, because he has a personality that has the potential for facing good conflict and not running. He also has the potential for being disobedient to godly authority, as you just discovered. It's the parent's duty to take this raw product and shape it with discipline until it is a virtue and not a vice. We need to stop prioritizing having easy children. If you want to raise adults who will rattle the gates of hell, you shouldn't be shocked by toddlers who rattle the gates of their crib. Motor scooters get very few speeding tickets, but they don't haul much cargo either. It takes a whole lot more work to train a temperamental racehorse than a house cat. But you also get a whole lot more benefit. And while children should never be permitted to be out of control, don't judge the long-term outcome by children based on how easy and pleasant they are to be around as 4 or 5-year-olds, and maybe be a little slower to judge their parents by those criteria either. Because those children that are just super easy and compliant, unless something changes, they're not going to accomplish very much in life, because being easy and compliant is not going to change the world. But harnessing that defiant 2-year-old so that that stubbornness is on the right things, well, that could make a difference. Harnessing those crazy emotions of your 4 or 5-year-old daughter, who's all over the map because she's so passionate and has no idea how to direct that passion, if that passion is directed and harnessed, it could become a beautiful and a beneficial thing for the world. We need to learn to encourage our children, not just by saying, "Oh, I just can't believe that you're so difficult." We need to see the goodness in their difficulty and point that out to them. Not just encourage ourselves, we need to encourage them. We need to see that here's where you're struggling, but here is how you've been gifted. Because most of the time, the flip side of that thing that is causing you to struggle so much is where their virtues lie. And you need to help them to see that, so that they see, well, it's not just that I won't be in trouble if I change. If I change, there's actually a good that could come out of this. And as always, we need to be balanced. We need to encourage our children when they feel like failures. We don't need to downplay their real failures or encourage them in their arrogance. So if your children think that they have the world by the tail, that's not the time to encourage them. Remember, we need to know the right medicine to apply, right? So the right medicine to apply when they are full of themselves is not to pump them up even fuller of themselves, right? We don't want to do that. But when they're weak and drooping and their knees are wobbling and they're like, "I can't do it. I'm never going to get any better. I'm always going to get in trouble for everything all the time. My middle name is no and life is a failure." Well, that's when maybe they need a little bit of encouragement cordial to say, "Hey, I see these virtues in you." Don't lie to them. But maybe you need to look with a little more with the eyes of love to see something beneficial to say. And maybe if you are looking at them to see a benefit, your attitude towards them might change, and you might see some ways that you've been provoking them to wrath, and the whole situation could improve. So we need to give them instruction And we need to give them encouragement. Any questions on encouragement before we move on to the other points? All right. Rolling up the sleeves, we're going to get to work here. Correction. When our children get out of line, we don't immediately go to punishment, or we shouldn't immediately go to punishment or even rebuke. We need to correct wrong behavior first. Because here's the thing, our children may not see what we see. We see, hey, they're doing this thing, and this thing is a problem, right? So, you're doing a problematic thing. Don't you know that? Well, they might not know that. And sometimes children can be little lawyers. They were like, I was talking to a young lady whose name will remain unmentioned this morning, and I said, you shouldn't be running. That was all the young ladies this morning, so... And this particular young lady said to me, I am not running, I'm galloping. Now, I'm pretty sure that she knew that running and galloping were the same thing. However, don't assume that that is always the case. It may be that they actually haven't made the connection between what you've told them and what they're doing. So before you harshly say, ah, don't you know that this is terrible what you're doing, right? You should say, do you know... that what you're doing is the same thing that I already told you not to do, right? And you help instruct them. So that's where correction comes in. Tripp says this about correction. Correction remedies something wrong. Correction gives your children insight into what is wrong and what may be done to correct the problem. Correction helps your children to understand God's standard and teaches them to assess their behavior against that standard. So when our children are out of line, you know, we need to have already had this big soil of instruction and encouragement and these other things. But before we just say, out of line, you crossed the line, do they know where the line is? And do they know that they're across it? Don't assume that that's the case. Give some correction to help them know what they ought to do. Well, there's also rebuke. Rebuke is strong censure. Some things ought to shock us. And it's right to register that shock with our children. We should not be full of anger at our children, but some things that our children do should make us angry and should receive an emotional rebuke. If your child says, I hate you to someone, we should not say simply, oh, I don't think you should say I hate you. Right? There's a time and a place for rebuke. We should never discipline it because they need to be taught what ought to shock them. That's what I'm getting at. So if everything, every correction is complete monotone, then they're going to assume that every infraction is completely equal. But we're trying to set their moral compass to know these are the things that ought not to be done, and these are the things that are heinous in God's sight, and you should never do them. Right? So we don't discipline in anger where we're out of control. But we need to have an appropriate degree of emotion so their emotional compass can be set. And we need to be careful. The strongest rebukes are reserved for the most important things. So if you play video games or you're reading a book and your children interrupt you, they should never see you upset or emotionally moved for that. If they have a moral compass in which interrupting dad is the greatest of crimes, that's a terrible moral compass to have. Here are the things that should merit sharp rebuke. Cruelty to animals or people. Cruel language. Like, these are things that are heinous and disgusting and ought to disgust them. And so they need to see that that behavior is repulsive to us. They need to know what's repulsive to God. And your emotion is what's going to teach them that. We're never shouting at them and yelling at them. That's not the kind of anger I'm talking about. But there's a point for sharp rebuke. Laziness, right? Laziness where you're being lazy and slothful and letting other people do work for you. There should be some emotion in your rebuke of that kind of behavior because it destroys people's lives. Not that it inconvenienced your day. That's not an appropriate time for a sharp rebuke. But when it has the potential to destroy their lives, part of communication needs to be rebuked because our children are watching us to learn our moral compass, and you see that in the scriptures, that there are some things that move God to wrath, and therefore there are some things that should move us to wrath, and our children are going to learn what makes God angry, but by watching what makes us angry, and sometimes we teach them the wrong lessons. And when we do, that brings us to our next point that you already mentioned, Hannah, and that is confession. This is simply a matter of consistency. If you're going to correct and even rebuke them when they do what's wrong, then that means you need to be willing to correct and even accuse yourself with strong emotion when you've crossed the lines that you've set for them. What's good for them is even better for you because you should know better. And this also helps them to set their emotional compass, right? So you should not be heartbroken because you spilled the milk. I mean, if you spilled their milk, you should say, I'm sorry I spilled your milk, right? That's what that merits. You know, you're handing them the milk, and you trip, and you spill it, I'm sorry. You lash out at them in sinful anger, you should be broken over that. And they should see that that has produced sincere sorrow in you because you have done what you ought not ever to have done, right? So they learn what things matter, not only by the things you correct them for, but by the emotion that you register when you apologize to them for the mistakes that you make. So that raises the question, what is it that you're most broken over in front of your children? Your children don't need to know every detail of your sin and your life, but when you've sinned against them, you need to go to them in humility. And the degree of your humility and brokenness should match the degree to which you have sinned against them. So we've talked about instruction, encouragement, correction, rebuke, and confession. Any questions about those before we move on to the next one? Affection. This is an important one. You need to lavish affection on your children through your speech. They need to know not just that you love them, but that you like them. And they need to know what it is you like about them, which some days, depending on their behavior, may require a little creativity on your part. But it's a creativity that's well worth investing in. God is not shy in telling us that he loves us, and we should not be shy in telling our children that we love them. Listen to these words from Jeremiah. The Lord hath appeared of old unto me, saying, yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn thee. It shouldn't always be, I love you, I love you, I love you. There are times for instruction and correction, reproof, all the others. All right, nope. That's what I said is true, but that wasn't what I was about to say. It shouldn't always be, I love you, but now I have to spank you. Right? If the only time you're telling your children that you love them is, I love you, but now here come the consequences. You know I love you, but you wouldn't guess that right now because the law is about to come down on your head. We should just tell them that we love them, just because. When they're not doing something wrong, take the opportunity to lavish them with affection. Tell your daughters that they're beautiful. Notice the growing strength of your sons. Praise them for whatever they do that is truly praiseworthy. Now, if you have children that are overly impressed with themselves, sometimes you'll have to not fan that flame. But when they do something that really is praiseworthy, take the opportunity to say, now that was good, right? If you tell them every artwork, you're going to be, you know, you should be a professional artist, right? That's not going to serve them well. But when they do something that's actually good, but now unless, you know, maybe they will be a professional artist, but even so, we should not say everything is not going to be equally good, right? But when they do something that is good, when they do something that is kind, when they do a project thoroughly, especially when it's the things that we've had to correct them for, and we're constantly have to correct them, you're lazy, you're lazy, you're lazy, you are lazy, you are lazy, and they do something that's not lazy, you should be even more intense. You weren't lazy! This is great! I am so happy about this! Right? That should be like, we want to be looking for opportunities to lavish them with affection. Look for opportunities to build up reserves in their emotional bank, because there are going to be times when you're going to have to draw on it. So affection. Entreaty. As I mentioned earlier, we constantly need to be alert to the form of communication that's needed by a particular child at a particular time. This is like, you need to know, not just have a full set of tools. Look at my tools. I've got an impressive set of tools. Well, if you take your electrical tools to fix a plumbing problem, it doesn't matter how impressive your tool collection is, you're going to make a mess, right? So we need to use the right tools for the right job. And that means, of course, knowing our children and knowing the seasons of their lives. We must not treat all children or all situations alike. Just as, and hopefully you with trucks can confirm if I've got this right, you wouldn't try to set a record for a straight run downhill in first gear. Am I right about that? I got it. Okay. Or try to pull a heavy load up a hill in ice and slush in fourth gear. Am I right about that? You wouldn't try to do that either, right? You need to have the right gear for the right job. So you shouldn't try to correct when you should encourage or rebuke when you should confess. You need to know the gear you ought to be in. And there's another gear that you need, another tool. You need another tool that you need, another gear you need to be prepared to shift into, and that is entreaty. This is what Tripp says about entreaty. This is communication that is earnest and intense. It involves pleading, soliciting, urging, and even begging. It's not, however, the begging of a beggar. It's rather the urgent pleading of a father or mother who, understanding his child the ways of God in the extremity of the moment, is willing to bear his soul in earnest pleading for his child to act in wisdom and faith. It's a special kind of communication that is reserved for use in cases of great import. Proverbs 23 contains a wonderful example of entreaty. My son, give me thine heart, and let thine eyes observe my ways. For a whore is a deep ditch, and a strange woman is a narrow pit. She also lieth in wait as for a prey, and increases the transgressors among men. That's an example of entreaty where you're saying, don't go that way. I'm pleading with you. Don't do that. Don't head that way. It will destroy you. Please, don't dishonor me in that way. Matthew 11, Jesus entreats us. He doesn't just say, hey, you know, you're headed for destruction, but come. If you come, I'll save you. Is that how Jesus calls to sinners? What does Jesus say? Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. You hear Christ pleading with sinners, come unto me. Don't head in that way that will lead to destruction. Plead with your children that they don't destroy themselves. When we discipline them, we shouldn't slack for their crying. When we plead with them, we shouldn't let up for their apparent disinterest. We may be getting through more than we realize, and even if we're not, it's still worth it not to have their blood on our hands. When they're just blank and they don't care, and they're completely disinterested, pour your heart out for their sake. We need to be prepared to engage in serious entreaty. This is what the emotional heartstrings are for. We talked when we gave the introduction to methods, talking about parenting methods last week, we talked about how some parents use emotional manipulation to just get their children to behave, right? It's like taking out your collectible gold coins and giving them to your two-year-old to play store with. Right? This is like the last resort that you have. You start out with that. You just, you know, give it to the cats to play with or whatever. What a bad decision, right? But that doesn't mean that you would never use those to ransom your child from kidnappers. If that's what you had to do, you would take everything out of the bank. You would empty your safety deposit box. You wouldn't say, well, you know, kidnappers got them. Kidnappers get kids sometimes. Well, that's that. No, you would do whatever it took to plead with them to say, let my children go, whatever that looked like. Depending on who it was, you know, who had them, you would try to rescue your children. At least I hope you would. But it's not just, you know, kidnappers out there who are trying to take your children. There are many evils that threaten the souls of our children in this world, and we should be prepared to plead with them and say, don't go there, don't do that. Closely tied with entreaty is warning. The emotions don't have to be at 110 every time. There are lots of dangers they need to be warned about. We need to paint vivid pictures of where they could end up. And we need to be honest, right? So when we paint vivid pictures, we shouldn't say ridiculous things that actually aren't true, right? So, you know, when you tell your children and you warn them against sexual sin, as you should, you know, don't tell them they're going to grow a third ear or something ridiculous like that, right? Some parents do that, not that, but some parents will lie to their children and conceal from them that the pleasures of sin can be sweet for a season. And then they find out, oh, the pleasures of sin are sweet for a season. My parents told me they weren't. They must have been wrong about everything, right? No, tell your children the truth, but warn them about where that path is going to lead them. Where's pornography going to take you if you start on that path at 12 years old? It's going to destroy your life, but you may not realize it until you're 32 years old and your marriage is falling apart. And you don't know how to look your kids in the eyes anymore, right? That's the picture you've got to get them to see when you're warning them. Don't just make up made-up stories. Well, don't do that. Something terrible will happen. You've got to warn them about the real dangers that they face in life. The book of Proverbs is so good for this. Tripp gives some great examples. Laziness ends in slave labor. He who ignores discipline comes to poverty and shame. Mere talk leads only to poverty. A harsh word stirs up anger. Pride goes before destruction. He who builds a high gate invites destruction. The shiftless man goes hungry, right? These are the warnings of the book of Proverbs, and we need to be applying them to our children. Hey, this ain't going to work out well. This seems like a great idea at the time, but this is where that path leads, right? And it's not always that 110 emotion impleting them where they're about to make a terrible choice. It's just giving those warnings day in and day out and day in and day out. We are trying to teach them how to work. Laziness is not going to end well. Laziness is not going to end well. Let me tell you a story about how laziness is going to end up. Let me tell you another story about how laziness is going to end up, right? And you keep chipping away at the rock tumbler, keep spinning that rock tumbler, and you're warning them. And in that mix, some of the grit that you need in the rock tumbler is these warnings of how things are going to go if they keep on these paths that they're on. So warning. Example, our communication isn't limited to what we plan on saying for our children. We're communicating all the time. Doug Wilson has a great example about this in his book, Why Children Matter. Parents have a tendency to mislabel the lesson. Imagine a basic showdown scenario. Suppose a toddler is standing at the coffee table right across from you and repeatedly wants to mess with the vase. Suppose further that the toddler has just gotten mobile and you have not childproofed the house yet, and they keep wanting to touch the vase. Too often, parents think that the lesson is entitled, How Not to Mess with Vases, when the actual lesson is called, How Not to Get Exasperated with Other People. You are teaching the toddler how not to get exasperated with other people when they cross you repeatedly, and that's the real lesson you're teaching them. If you do not know how to be patient in the face of repeated provocations, your children are not going to know either. When you discipline your children correctly, you are loving your grandchildren. Your job is not to teach them how to be an acceptable child, but to show them how to be a responsible adult, because that is the whole point. And that's really good. So it's not just the things that we say to our children. It's the things that we show to our children, like the right communication tool for the job, or like knowing our limitations when we know that, you know, we think that we've got the tool for the job and we're going to tackle it, and we realize, oh, I'm in over my head. And we show them an example of humility by getting help, right? That's maybe the bigger lesson that they need to learn. Finally, prayer. Now, there's two sides to this, or many sides to this. First, we should be communicating to God about our children. We should be praying for our children. Our children should hear us pray for them in family devotions and other times. And we should teach our children how to pray. And we should listen to our children when they pray, because often that's going to tell us a lot about what's really going on in their hearts. So, which of these types of communication do you struggle with the most or even ignore altogether? So which of these, if you're feeling especially brave tonight, is one that has been a struggle to you, or perhaps was a struggle in the past, and maybe you've overcome that? Jake?
I would say the constant repeating in my patience level. That is my biggest failure that I see in myself, is the constant nagging, and then I explode, or them repeatedly disobeying, and then I overreact. That would be my issue.
And that is one. And how do you think Andrew. How do you think that has affected, like, you know, sometimes we get one thing wrong and that affects other areas. Have you seen other areas that has affected as you struggle with that one point? How's that affected maybe the job as a whole?
So my wife brings this up to me when we have our discussions about, you know, especially when we read the book and we talk about the book. So it actually, I think it's kind of helped me in other areas because I recognize it. But for some reason, in that instance, and I can see the kids when they constantly do it, they're expecting it. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I catch it before it happens. But I don't really see it. I don't know. For instance, my oldest one, I can explode and it doesn't bother him at all. He just lets it roll off his back. The other two, they shut down. They stop listening, and they retreat. Elizabeth will run and hide because she's scared. James will just mope and not listen to anybody anymore. So I guess I see it shut them down when I do it. But Michael, he just doesn't bother him at all. It's weird. I don't understand that. But
well, I think that's really self-aware of what you're saying, you know, that you see how this one area can affect other areas of communication that maybe you're in a, you know, you confess, but maybe they're still in, you know, retreat mode, so they're not even able to recognize the confession that you would make, or you want to encourage them, and they're not in a position to receive that encouragement. And so it's something that, you know, sometimes when you try to do the job with the wrong tool, you make such a mess that other people coming by with the right tools, you know, it's like, hey, I got this screwdriver and I tried to fix the drain and it didn't work. Well, now I've got a full, you know, a plumber here, and now it's going to cost me twice as much, you know, to fix the job because I used the wrong tool that one time. And that is something, you know, where I needed a torque wrench or whatever, and I, you know, over-torqued it, right? And so all of us have that place where we see, hey, here's where the damage has been caused, but all of
but
us
I
do that.
But I do go and apologize to my children when I blow up, because I do know it's wrong, and I do agree with apologizing so they can see.
Yeah, and I think that's really good what you're saying.
And I can see them recover from that, you know, and I'll explain to them why I overreacted and stuff like that. But
I think that's just really important, working on, you know, all the aspects of communication. That's why we're not talking about this, because, you know, some of us have all of this mastered, and others would like, hey, we need to impart our perfect wisdom. But we all need to go to the Word of God and say, hey, all of us have areas of weakness. We need to identify those, and then work on changing them and make progress so that we can be better at communicating with our children next year than we were this year. And I think that's the heart that all of us should have. Anyone else? All right. So we talked about different types of communication. Just review the list here. Instruction, encouragement, correction, rebuke, confession, affection, entreaty, warning, example, and prayer. And of course, it'd be possible to expand that list even a little bit more. The next thing is just a few points on tips for communication. There's just two things that didn't quite fit in the other points, so I've made a middle point on tips for communication. One is consistency in communication. Using the same, when you're giving instructions, especially when you're giving instructions, we'll talk more about this when we talk about rules, but especially when you're instructing little children, be consistent in your word choice. So if you're trying to teach them not to fuss, and you say, no fussing, and then the next day you say, no whining, and the next day you say, no throwing a hissy fit, and the next day you say, no grumbling, well, in your mind, you know that hissy fit is an extreme form of fussing, and grumbling and whining, it's all the same thing. You should not assume
that a two-year-old understands that. And it will be much simpler if you define, here's what fussing is, and use that consistently. This is not something most of us, I don't do this perfectly, but it's one of the things that I read that really seemed beneficial, that being consistent in the language that we use, that we define, and this is one of the things, husbands and wives getting on the same page, so this is something, you know, especially with Allie, because she's really little, I'll ask Ashley, so have you been working on X with her, and what do you call it, right? What is it that you've said, don't, you know, is it be still? Is it don't, you know, when you're changing her diaper, is it be still? Is it don't roll? Is it don't move? What is it? What's the language that you've told her that she knows so I can use the same language that she's been using all throughout the day? And so I think that's something, just that there was a helpful tip and one that we found helpful as well in our own parenting. And another thing, a quote from Farley's book on gospel-powered parenting, the importance of your marriage and the example of communication in your marriage, not just your direct communication with your children. So I just thought this quote really stood out to me, so I wanted to share it with you. With their children all day, homeschooling moms face a great temptation to center their lives and affections on their children. Convinced that it is what they do or don't do with their children that will prove decisive, they make their children the center of their lives and affections. I contend that it is how they love their husbands that will ultimately prove decisive. In other words, marriage-centered, not child-centered moms usually exert the greatest influence on their children for Christ and his kingdom. What is true for moms with their spouses is also true for husbands with their wives. Communication with your spouse often matters more than communication with your children directly. Because, remember, they're learning by example. They learn how you communicate. They learn what matters. And so if they need to learn that life is not all about them, that's an important lesson, but also they're going to learn how to love their spouse by how you love your spouse. They're going to learn how to talk to other adults by seeing how adults talk to one another, right? And that's the goal. The goal isn't to have children that are compliant, that can manage your rules. The goal is to have children that can go out into the world and make a difference. They're going to learn that by observing what kind of an adult you are. And the biggest way they're going to observe that is the most important relationship in your life, namely with your spouse. And scripturally, the priority of marriage first and then children is very clear. And so you need to show them the appropriate priorities. And sometimes you could be so eager to pay attention to your children that you neglect your husband, or perhaps you neglect your wife because you're so eager to pay attention to your children or your job or whatever else it is. And all of the boxes you check with communication with your children directly go wasted because they see that your priorities are out of line and they learn the wrong priorities. And so the importance of your marriage, I think in talking about communication, that it's not just communication with our children directly that's important, but the communication that they see us have with others, and most importantly, with our spouses. So we talked about types of communication and tips for communication, and our last point tonight is a life of communication. We can't just talk to our kids. So you can have all the right tools, and you can know when you're supposed to use the right tools. So you could have not just the right equipment, not just the knowledge of when to use that equipment. You could have all of that. But if you only dust off the tools once in a blue moon, a lot of work is not going to get done. We can't just talk when something is dramatically wrong with our kids. The kind of full-orb communication we're talking about needs to be a lifestyle to which we give ourselves day in and day out. And we need to count the cost of entering into a life of communication in our families and with our children. It isn't always going to be convenient. Tripp is very good on this point, so I'm going to read somewhat of an extended quote from the book here. Honest, thorough, truly biblical communication is expensive. Insightful and penetrating conversations take time. Children require both time and flexibility. Children do not pour their hearts out or open themselves up on a demand schedule. A wise parent talks when the kids are in the mood. Every so often, they'll ask a question, make a comment, reveal some little aspect of their heart. In those times when their conscience is stirred, you need to talk. This may require dropping everything else to seize a critical moment. Now, if they consistently, day after day, are raising heart-stirring questions 10 minutes after bedtime, 5 days a week, you might start to question how stirred their conscience really is. But there are going to be those times when it is after bedtime and their conscience really is stirred and you need to change your plans for the night to talk to your kids. There's a simple way to look, Tripp says, at the cost of deep forward communication. You must regard parenting as one of your most important tasks while you have children at home. This is your calling. You must raise your children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. You cannot do so without investing yourself in a life of sensitive communication in which you help them understand life and God's world. There is nothing more important. You have only a brief season of life to invest yourself in this task. You have only one opportunity to do it. You can't go back and do it over again. You live in a culture in which there are opportunities for you to do things unheard of in history. You are presented daily with scores of options for investing your life's energies and creativity. There is more than you could ever do, and you must therefore prioritize. Parenting is your primary calling, and parenting will mean that you can't do all the things you could otherwise do. It will affect your golf handicap, should you play golf. It may mean your home does not look like a picture from Better Homes and Gardens, or I would update the book by adding the Magnolia Journal. It will impact your career and ascent on the corporate ladder, or even perhaps the shipyard. It will alter the kind of friendships you'll be able to pursue. It will influence the kind of ministry you're able to pursue. It'll modify the amount of time you have for bowling or hunting, television, or how many books you read. It will mean you can't develop every interest that comes along. The cost of communication are high. And yet, though the cost of developing a life of communication with your children are great, those costs are worth it. We need to count the cost. Because remember the importance of consistency. If we're like, I'm going to communicate with my kids, and we make all these commitments to them, and something else comes up 3 weeks later, and we're like, sorry, kids, this other thing came up, and so, this lifestyle of communication we were talking about, we're back to, discipline when you are naughty. That's sort of what we're going to settle down to, right? That'd be far better to never promise than to promise and never deliver. But though the costs are high, the costs are not the whole story. We also need to count the blessings of developing a life of communication. We need to realize that from the day they're born until the day they leave our homes, our power over our children is in constant decline. Newborns are completely dependent on their parents. Toddlers only slightly less so. Whether they like it or not, you are bigger than them. You know more than them. You have more than them. And they are incapable of life without you. Hopefully this is not news to you, but this is not always going to be the case. Round about the time they need your authority more than ever, your power over them is going to begin to plummet. And this is why this life of communication is so important. Because it's communication that creates the sort of relationship in which children are willing to place themselves under your authority when you don't have the power to keep them there. Our goal as parents, is to use communication to develop influence with our children. So when we no longer have power over them, we still have influence with them. And we can help them on their journey through life to flourish. Children need to be willing to place themselves under your authority because they know they can trust you, that you're not going to try to hurt them, that they can depend on you. Tripp says this trust has several elements. Children trust you when they know you love them and are committed to their good, when they know you understand them, when they know you understand their strengths and weaknesses, when they know you've invested yourself in encouragement, correction, rebuke, entreaty, instruction, warning, understanding, teaching, and prayer. When a child knows that all his life you've sought to see the world through his eyes, he'll trust you. When he knows you've not tried to make him like you or like anybody else, but only sought to help him realize his full potential as a creature God made to know him and live in the relationship of fellowship with him, then he'll trust you. So here's the question. What are you doing to build that kind of trust right now? What are you doing to develop that kind of relationship? There's nothing you can do to make the teenage years easy. But there's a lot you can do to keep them from being hellish. If you spend the first 12 years of life doing nothing but laying down the law, you are headed for trouble. You've had this plant, and it's growing, and it's growing, and it's growing, and it's got these roots, and you've never added soil to the pot. And it keeps getting put. We could change the metaphor a little bit, right? So you keep putting it in a bigger and bigger pot, and you never add any more dirt. What's going to happen? It's going to die. It's going to till over. It's going to make a mess. And even if you try to water it, it'll end up getting waterlogged. All sorts of bad things are going to happen. And so, as our children are growing and growing and growing, we need to be getting a bigger pot and getting a whole lot more soil to fill that pot. And that soil is this life of communication that we've been talking about. It's not just, don't go there, don't do that. It's teaching them about life. It's encouraging them. It's exhorting them. It's pouring our hearts out for them. All the things we've been talking about. If, on the other hand, you spend the first 12 years of life engaged in constant instruction and encouragement and correction, rebuke, confession, affection, entreaty, warning, example, prayer, and all the rest, then when things get difficult for them, as they will, they'll be prepared to run to you with their difficulties rather than away from you at the earliest possible opportunity. Your power over your children is diminishing every single day. You get a calendar. Put a negative mark every day. Another negative tally mark. That's your power over your children going down. Are there any positive check marks? Developing influence with them. That's the job of communication. That's what we ought to be striving for. And you know what? There'll be days where there's a couple negative check marks and no positive ones. But if there's month after month after month, withdrawal, 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 no deposits, no deposits, no deposits. Round about the time you need to write the biggest checks of your life with your children, no, you can't go out with that guy. You shouldn't drive that way. You're going to lose your license. Son, I know you don't understand this, but this job is really bad for you, and I can't make you quit, but you need to quit because this environment is destroying your soul. What you got in the bank to cover that kind of check? You can't make a deposit big enough to cover that. Your daughter's been seeing someone for a few months, and you realize something about them, and she doesn't get it, but you know the kind of character that young man has, even if you don't have the receipts for it yet. What you got in the bank to cover that check? Oh, you better be making deposits now. Those deposits start when she's 5, 6, 7, where she knows that you love her and you have affection for her. And she knows that in her soul. And she knows you're not trying to just keep her from life and joy. And you can write that check. And if she chooses to not let you cash it, it's on her and not on you. God forbid it be on you. We need to build the foundation for influence with our children right now. Most of you, I hope, are doing something to prepare for retirement. If you wait to think about retirement till you're 60, it's not going to go very well. The time to prepare for retirement is now. And some of us should be doing more than we're presently doing. But the time for retirement is now, not when you're 70 and you're like, oh, I guess I should start saving because I can't keep working anymore. And now it's a mess. The same thing is true with our children. You should start the day you take them home from the hospital preparing for the day they go off to college or trade school or work or whatever it is that they go off to do. Let's go before we finish. We have a few more minutes. Any questions or comments on what we've covered before we wrap up? Gil, a mic is headed your way.
I just wanted to reemphasize the comment earlier about being encouraging to your children when they finally do something right that they've not done right for a long time. That can be, that's something I'm seeing just destroy people that are trying to make positive changes, children and teenagers and adult men, everyone.
Yeah.
When someone, you know, finally does it right and they either get no recognition or just it's about time or something like that. That's a big deal. So
celebrate the milestones.
Was, yeah.
Or when you're like, well, okay, you got that right, but here's what you still got wrong.
Yeah.
And don't do that. Yep. Yeah. That's so so
just
helpful.
Just be encouraging.
Yeah.
When someone makes progress in something.
And this isn't that's just big. For Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
This isn't just for parents and kids. You could do this with other adults too. When you see someone who you know has struggled with something, you got to be careful. If they don't know they're struggling with something, then your encouragement could come across as a deep insult. So, you know, if they don't realize they've been struggling and they just happen to do a different one time and you're like, you did it! You're like, what did I do? Right. That could use some wisdom is needed. But when you know that a brother or sister has been struggling, and especially if they've confided in you, and you see, hey, you did what you were supposed to do, give them a phone call. Send them a text. Write them a letter. That would be a shocking thing to do. Right? These are good things to do to encourage one another. Let's close in prayer. Oh, Gilead has one more comment.
Real quick. Sometimes that can just look like nothing. It's weird. But when someone's used to getting negatives all the time for something, you can also blow it out of proportion if they do something well, finally. Like, kind of like you were saying. Even if you have talked about it and, like, you two are aware of your overzealous in your encouragement, that can be just as harmful.
Yeah, you don't want to treat them like they're a six-year-old. Yeah. It's like, or well, let's see. You don't want to treat them like a three-year-old who learned how to use the potty. That would not be helpful. Yeah. There are ways to encourage, and sometimes that's a very quiet way.
Yeah, I mean, a smiling nod sometimes is all it takes.
Yep.
Yeah.
There are subtle ways of encouraging, for sure. That's a good point. Anyone else? Andrea.
I would just like to share, as a parent with older kids, it's the relationship is between your older children is super important.
Mm.
Because when you are training them to recognize good and bad advice and discerning who they should be listening to, and also to have older men and women come alongside your kids and disciple them is critical. Because
Absolutely.
They need to see that same resolve and relationship in you and other people, and that they're directing in the same way.
Yes.
And this church is fantastic for that. There's so many women who've come alongside my girls and encourage them in the same way that we would raise them.
Amen. Praise the Lord for that. That is encouraging to hear. Anyone else? All right. Father, I come before you tonight. I thank you for the glorious task that you've given us to raise children and even to come alongside others, even when we haven't children of our own, and labor together in this great task. Help us to count the cost and then count the blessings and realize that the blessings far outweigh the cost. Help us to be willing to make the sacrifices now, so that we won't have to bewail and lament our failures later on. I pray this in Christ's name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.